First of all, I want to launch a preemptive strike against any critics who might accuse this talk of being ad hominem. First place, the ad hominem fallacy is that you attack, instead of attacking the doctrine of the person, you attack the person. And that's fallacious because it doesn't refute the argument. I've never been in favor of that. I've always been in favor of refuting the doctrine and then going on to attack the person. So that's not an ad hominem fallacy. Also, what I'm going to talk about, the person of Keynes, I think is related directly to his ideas. And so I think it's also important historically what sort of a person he was and how that did relate to his ideas. Okay, first I'm going to start by saying that Keynes' favorite political philosopher might surprise many of you as to who it was. It was Edmund Burke. An interesting question, why was Edmund Burke? Why, here's somebody who's Edmund Burke, the darling of conservatives or neoconservatives or whatever. And here's Keynes, who was certainly not conservative in that sense, one would think. He was a little bit more democratic than Burke. Burke was an 18th century, working in an 18th century political system, which was hardly democratic. So if you're more democratic than Burke, it doesn't say much. He was also thought that Burke left out some of the great political ideas or great ideologies that statesmen should pursue. But the three basic reasons why he liked Burke a lot were precisely, by the way, the three basic reasons why I dislike Burke. First place, he liked the fact that Burke was opposed to abstract principles. Keynes always hated principles all of his life. One time he said in a speech or a testimony, "I'm afraid of principle," per se, that is. And he was against principles, and he particularly was against individual rights. And of course, Burke was against individual rights. Burke believed in expediency against abstract or natural rights. And this is one of the great reasons why Keynes liked them. Now, there are certain Burke theorists who claim that Burke really, really did believe in individual rights. I don't agree with them, but the point is I'm talking about why Keynes liked Burke. So Keynes liked Burke, one, because he was against principles and particularly against abstract individual rights. Two, he liked Burke because Burke was in favor of focusing on present goods and ignoring future benefits, future goals. In other words, Burke's conservatism, the fact that Burke didn't like the idea of any kind of change or radical change because he worried about future consequences, which we wouldn't know, this is a short-term position, of course. This fits in with Keynes's admiration for the short run and hatred of the long run. So Keynes's idea in the long run we're all dead fits in with a Burkean idea. You should concentrate on current, present questions or present costs and not worry about, not consider future benefits too much. So in other words, Burke's political philosophy was a high time preference philosophy, as was Keynes's whole outlook, which is very much in favor of present benefits, present goods, as against future. As Keynes put it, quote, "It is the paramount duty of governments and of politicians to secure the well-being of the community under the case in the present and not to run risks over much for the future." So the present orientation fits into the same with Keynes's short-run orientation. And thirdly, he admired the fact that Burke believed and ruled by an organically arrived at elite, a ruling class, ruling elite of British establishment big shots. And of course, since Keynes was a British establishment big shot, this fit in beautifully with Keynes's world outlook. As Keynes, to quote Keynes, "the machine itself," that means the British state, "the machine itself," I'm quoting from Skidelsky on Keynes, "the machine itself he believed to be sound enough if only the ability and integrity of those in charge of it could be assured." That's the key. And somebody said that this weekend, that who cares about, I mean, the state is great. Who cares about, you shouldn't have restrictions on government rule. The state is great, provided that we know the people in charge of it are great guys, people of integrity and ability, et cetera, which of course means they organically arrived at British ruling elite, i.e. himself. Okay, so these three things, I think, mark Keynes throughout his life. Short run, attack on principles and individual rights, and belief in the ruling elite, with himself among it. Okay, Keynes starts off, first of all, his whole life was born with a silver spoon in his mouth, so to speak. He was his father was a big shot at Cambridge. John Neville Keynes was a controller at Cambridge Cambridge for many years. He also was also very important for Keynes's development and career. His father was a close friend of Alfred Marshall, and also Marshall had certain obligations. He felt he had certain obligations to Keynes, namely that to Neville, because apparently Neville was a close friend of Keynes, a promising scholar, but never accomplished much. The scholarly output was almost nil. He wrote a book on methodology, which was sort of a pedestrian book on methodology, and didn't write anything else. As often happens in academia, if you can't write anything, you go into academic administration. So he became a controller, financial controller of Cambridge. So Marshall always felt that Marshall was a nut in his own right. I'm not going to go into that. But anyway, Marshall always felt that he had a certain extra obligation to Neville that he didn't have to other people because Neville didn't accomplish, didn't achieve what he was supposed to have achieved. And so this obligation was placed on young Maynard. And so when Maynard got out of Cambridge and after it was a clerk in the office for a while, Marshall was going to retire, made sure that before he retired, that Keynes got a post as a lecturer in economics at his old college, Keynes College, Cambridge. And half of his salary was paid by Cambridge, the other half was paid by his father, John Neville. So this is how Keynes started off in academia. By the way, Keynes only had one term in economics when he started lecturing in economics. He'd taken one course in Marshall. This apparently was not unusual at the time in British academia. It was still kind of peculiar. However, he knew very little economics to begin with. He had Marshall, he read Marshall's principles. He learned on the job, so to speak, on the job training. And he read Marshall's principles. He had Marshall's oral tradition, in other words, his evidence before royal commissions and his unpublished papers, and that's essentially it. A key thing about Keynes also, which has come out in recent years, he was a member and leader of the Secret Society of the Apostles, the Cambridge Apostles, a very powerful in-group at Cambridge. And the thing is, it wasn't just a college fraternity group. It met for the rest of Keynes' life. In other words, they had continual meetings until Keynes died. They go back to Cambridge and have meetings and sessions, et cetera, et cetera. And the first characteristic that comes out with Keynes's attitudes at the Apostles and everywhere else, first place, Keynes's constant emphasis on personal power and domination, up to brutal domination of his fellow people, whoever is involved. In other words, power and dominance were the key to his personal relationships. Second of all, he was very interested in philosophy. Philosophy ruled his life, and the philosophy which he adopted was the philosophy of G.E. Moore. David Gordon has mentioned this before, but I'm now interested not so much in Moore himself, but in Keynes's interpretation of Moore and Keynes's reaction to it. Moore is also a Cambridge apostle, and we're all close friends in this group. And the philosophy which seemed to dominate Keynes was a bitter attack on bourgeois morality. This seems to be the key to Keynes's life and thought. An attack on any kind of conventional or middle class or bourgeois morality, both in personal matters, sexual matters, and in ideological matters. So it's an attack on heterosexuality as inferior, attack on thrift, attack on bourgeois family life, and the whole business. And Schumpeter sort of alludes to this in a sort of a subtle fashion by constantly talking about Keynes's childless vision. So Keynes' emphasis on the short-run hedonism, et cetera, as being a key to life. So the attack on thrift starts from the very beginning, and this attack culminates in his call for the euthanasia of the rentier class, the mercy killing of the creditor class, which is the epitome of bourgeois life, the thrifty creditor and thrifty saver. Okay, his interpretation of G.E. Moore, they keep referring, they will know more than I do about this, they keep referring to Moore as a pure, more tremendous personal charisma, apparently, with Keynes and everybody else, and they keep referring to the purity of his intellect, the fact that he was pure, he's sort of like a living embodiment of pure intellect. He had no small talk, he would make sort of crazy statements. To me, he sounds like a nutty poseur, but what do I know? He's not my type of guy, let's say, put it that way. At any rate, he seemed to impress everybody else at King's College, Cambridge. And when Moore wrote the Principia Ethica in 1903, Keynes said in retrospect and said at the time, so we have two checks here. In other words, he said, this is the great revelation. Quoting from Keynes, the book was exciting, exhilarating, the beginning of a new renaissance, the opening of a new heaven on earth. Talking about Keynes' millennialism, that's an interesting phrase here. That's what he said in retrospect about 30 years later when he was talking about Principia Ethica. At the time, he said it was stupendous, entrancing, the greatest book on the subject, wondrous and original, a true theory of ethics. Now, it seems to be that the true theory of ethics basically was, at least the way Keynes interpreted it, was a rejection of bourgeois morality and rejection of any kind of general rules. Keynes hated most of all in life is general rules. And ethical rules or any other sort of rules, and therefore an emphasis on personal whim, personal caprice, personal will. See, I think it fits in with Keynes' entire will to power. And he felt that any general rules were limited the freedom freedom to power on the part of the individual. So the shift to a personal ethics, personal friendship, personal love, personal beauty, contemplation of beauty, things of that sort, as against obeying any sort of general rules. Moore, by the way, this is sort of interesting reflection of the Moore's attack on bourgeois morality or any kind of moral principle. One of his famous statements was, from Moore, quote, we should spread skepticism until at last everyone knows we can know absolutely nothing, unquote. It sounds self-contradictory to me, by the way. And again, he stressed the perfect love and friendship as being a key, the only thing we can bank on, only goals in life. And here's the way Keynes looked back on it, on the Moore circle, okay? Years later. He said, we entirely repudiated a personal liability on us to obey general rules. This was a very important part of our faith. Interesting words there, faith. Violently and aggressively held, and for the outer world, it was our most obvious and dangerous characteristic. We repudiated entirely customary morals, conventions, and traditional wisdom. We were, that is to say, in the strict sense of the term, immoralists. And at the age of 55, on the eve of World War II, Keynes said that the Moorite creed is still, quote, my religion under the surface. I remain and always will remain an immoralist, unquote. And Keynes also wrote that one of the greatest advantages of Moore's theory was that it made morals unnecessary. Some interesting comments on the Moorite circle, including Keynes at the time. Beatrice Webb, talking about Moore and the Moore people, of course she knew them very well, she said the whole ethical doctrine which they pursued was, quote, nothing but a metaphysical justification for doing what you like, what other people disapprove of, unquote. Also a very keen insight, I think, of the Moore circle, that Bertrand Russell, who was also an apostle, Cambridge apostle, and knew all these people very well. And what he said is that Keynes and the other group, Keynes, Strachey, and the other Moore people, quote, aim rather at a life of retirement among fine shades and nuanced and nice feelings, among fine shades and nice feelings, and conceived of the good as consisting consisting of the passionate mutual admirations of a clique of the elite, unquote. I think it's a beautiful summation of Moorite doctrine and Moorite practice at the time. The passionate mutual admirations of a clique of the elite. Of course, they were the clique of the elite. Now, one interesting thing is apparently Keynes also said that the one chapter in Moore's Principia Ethica, which they ignored, was this, I think, penultimate chapter called Ethics in Relation to Conduct. When Moore tries to set up general rules, and this is, of course, they disregarded. Now, another fascinating thing in the Skidelsky book about Keynes is that apparently, as David mentioned, the first, from, say, 1904 to 1914, I believe it is, Keynes' whole leisure time was devoted to his treatise on probability, thinking about probability and writing the book. The book was published in 1921, but was written before the war. So, and apparently the reason why he arrived at this was he was trying to destroy general rules. In other words, basically he was trying to destroy the idea of general rules of conduct and general causal rules and causal rules in general. So Moore had apparently fallen back on a frequentist theory of probability. In other words, fall back on probabilistic causal doctrine, where you say, well, at least something is probable, and therefore you go on that basis. So Kane's being against the idea of a realistic cause and effect in the real world. Came to the conclusion, no, we have to eliminate the frequentist theory, because at least that's too realistic. We have to claim the probability theory is purely logical and a priori. So we have an a priori logic, which then has no relation to the real world. No, there's no relation to individual instances. So even if, for example, let's say the probability of a two-spot on a dice is 1/6, on a die is 1/6, you have to say it has nothing to do with individual die throwing. So this cuts any relationship. So the probability is pure logical a priorism. Has nothing to do with the real world. This eliminates any threat that the real world might be governed in some sense by general rules. So in other words, this whole treatise on probability is essentially part of a Moreite attack on general principles, general rules. By the way, Richard von Mises, Ludwig von Mises' brother, was the great developer of the frequentist theory of probability, and Ludwig took it over in Human Action. You know, he apparently disliked his brother intensely, but not really admit it. But I think that's pretty clear. Okay, having done this, and by the way, another thing about Keynes's personal and ideological cultural life is he gets involved in the 19-teens in that period, and also in the 1920s with the Bloomsbury set. I think somebody, David mentioned this yesterday, or somebody else. And the Bloomsbury set was also Virginia Woolf and Leonard Woolf and Vanessa Bell and all these people. It was mostly King's College and other Cambridge people, almost all of them. The males, of course, were Cambridge people, and even the females were going to, I think, Pemberton College in Cambridge. And their whole life and their whole writings were essentially attacks on bourgeois morality. It was the whole point of the whole business. And so it all fits into the Keynes's person, lifestyle, and ideology. In 1913, he gets his first. Worked in the India office before he gets back to Cambridge. Keynes he graduates in 1906 and he goes into the India office as a clerk, and goes back in 1908. Gets his position partially paid for by his father, and he becomes an India currency and finance expert. Now, typical. This, by the way, of course, is typical of British attitude to India in general. It's not just Keynes. In all of his work in the India office, he had never expressed the slightest interest whatsoever in the Indians and in British imperialism, Indian colonialism, anything of that sort. The idea of British rule as a natural development just assumed it. He also showed no interest whatsoever in ever visiting India as an India expert. This, by the way, is typical. Also true. Also, James Mill and John Stuart Mill, both India experts, both rulers of the East India Company, never had any intention whatsoever of visiting India. The thought was important to visit it. At any rate, and as Joe Salerno said, he was from the very beginning against the gold standard in favor of managed credit and expansionary credit. In 1913, he gets his first big government post on the Royal Commission on Indian Finance and Currency. And he's put in there by his friend Edwin Montague, who was his patron and mentor way back in college. And he writes his defense of the gold exchange standard as a reaction to the great Montague silver scandal at the time. Montague and his relatives and friends and a whole bunch of other people were involved in the big scandal. And he defended the scandal tried to defend them as an honorable, honest citizens, et cetera. At any rate, and this Indian currency thing was part of that move. And of course, he calls for the gradual elimination of the gold standard, as Joe said. There's an interesting phrase here in his book. He's in his book, Indian Finance and Currency. He says, gold is, quote, a relic of a time when governments were less trustworthy in these matters than they are now. In other words, what you need is good people, trustworthy people to run the thing, and then you don't have to have a gold standard. Trustworthy people, of course, meaning the English ruling elite, that is, including himself. This, of course, then we get in the general theory that gold is a barbarous relic. He also called in the book for a central bank in India, the blessings of a central bank. And again, he wanted a discretionary monetary policy which would not be limited by general rules. It's always a key thing, a theme in Keynesian doctrine. As a result of his he gets to know Sir Basil Blackwell, who was Secretary of the Royal Commission, and indeed, I guess, when World War I comes, he immediately gets a key post in the Treasury and goes on from there to fame and fortune. Okay, next theme I think I want to stress in Keynesian doctrine, is Keynesian life and doctrine, is his personal arrogance. Incredibly arrogant, which goes along with his will to power. And including in his arrogance is his willingness to have a systemic use of lies and deceit in order to gain his ends. One of the things, by the way, which have been noted at the time and now, is this quick change of viewpoint. He was a passionate free trader for a long time. Then he suddenly becomes a passionate protectionist. Then he shifts back to passionate free trade. And he was attacked in the English press in the early 1930s for being an economic acrobat, India rubber man, and a boneless man for this swift change of position. But all, first of all, in all these positions, he was in favor of government management. And second of all, of course, he was the will to power to him was much more important than these rules, which you know, can be shifted at will. In fact, he went so far as to attack truth and politics even in general. There's a quote from Keynes. A preference for truth or for sincerity as a method may be a prejudice based on some aesthetic or personal standard inconsistent in politics with a general with a practical good. So people's liking of truth is just some sort of queer aesthetic. It obviously comes back to bourgeois morality, which should be tossed over by statesmen who want to engage in public welfare. Also, there's a hint there that Keynes was in favor of exaggeration and lies while he was out of power. When he gets into power, he wants to be more prudent. He says at one point, words ought to be a little wild, but after he gets into power, quote, there should be no more poetic license. Harry Johnson points out in his book on Keynes that Keynes was always convinced on any issue whatsoever, whatever it happens to be, that no one was doing anything about it, regardless of how serious the problem was. No one else was doing anything about it, and if they were, they were wrong. Only Keynes was right on any conceivable question. So Keynes was right on every question, not because he had general consistent principles, because we've seen he hasn't, but because he was right. He was the superior elite person with the will to power. He believed, apparently, I would just call Keynes an egomaniac. He believed that he could conquer any problem quickly and come to the right conclusions on it. It's typical of Keynes, for example, he told Hayek, this is a famous thing among Hayekians at any rate, he told Hayek at the end of his life that if his disciples went too far with inflation and public debt, he could always change things around. He'd just snap his fingers and everything would shift. Unfortunately, Keynes died and left us with his long run. So we're now living in the Keynesian long run. He's happily dead. The most typical thing about it, Keynes' intellectual arrogance, intellectual irresponsibility, was the way he reviewed Mises' Money and Credit when it came out in German. He was an editor of the Economic Journal for many years, and as an editor, he reviewed in a short book note. And what he said about the book was something like that. It was very short. He said, well, it's a useful book. The author is of the highest enlightened view, something like that, which I don't know quite what that means, anyway, highest enlightened views. But the book is disappointing because there's nothing original in it. That's the way he summed it up. And whatever you think of Mises' theory of money and credit, it was blazingly original. One thing you can't say about it was just the old trite stuff. And he writes in his treatise on money 20 years later in a footnote that, well, you know, he doesn't really know German. He knows German fairly well, but he only knows German enough to understand ideas that he already knows. He can't understand any new ideas in German. I want you to contemplate for a moment the chutzpah, the unmitigated gall of somebody who admits that he doesn't know German well enough to understand any new ideas and then attack Mises for not having any new ideas. Only Keynes can do that. Like, okay. Also, I think his strategy in the general theory was that of a chronic liar. I think no other way you can put it. For example, he says in the general theory, when he talks about history of thought, which he does quite a bit in there, that nobody before him even worried about unemployment, much less thought about it. He was the only one, he, John Maynard Keynes, the only one ever to think about unemployment and worry about it, think about the solution. And he lived in a time, of course, that everybody before him he called classical economists, a sneer. And he lived at a time when Hayek and Hayek's doctrines have become important precisely because it had tackled the unemployment problem, whether you agree with it or not. So he knew that Austria, he knew about Austrian theory, at least tackling the unemployment problem. He knew about the Pigou and so forth talking about unemployment, and yet he had the gall to claim he was the first one to ever think about it. And unfortunately, most economists since Keynes are not steeped in the history of economic thought. It's not one of the great strengths of the profession. It died out almost because as the economists began to think of economics as like physics, if you're a physicist, you don't really bother dealing with 18th century physics. And so he got away with it. He managed to persuade most of the profession that nobody before Keynes worried about unemployment or had any solution to offer, any theory to offer about it. That, I think, is the most flagrant case of obvious lie. There's no way you can get around that. He also lied about Say's law. Again, everybody takes this as gospel. Everybody defines Say's law or cites it as being, quote, supply creates its own demand. That is not Say's law. First of all, Say, of course, never said anything like it. But the point is that Say's law, as Hutt points out, is that the supply of X constitutes a demand for Y, Z, etc. It's not that the supply of peaches creates a demand for peaches. The supply of peaches creates a demand for other products. The peach seller will then buy other things. So by misstating Say's law, making it seem like a loony law, you then, of course, can easily refute it. This is called a straw man tactic. And unfortunately, most historians of economic thought have taken this as gospel. Gee, Say's law says, the only thing they've done since Keynes is to put it in the math, oddly enough. Put Say's law in the math. Say did not use any mathematics. Say was very sound on the mathematical economics question. He also said that, well, this might be a common fact. He might not have lied about this. He might have been honestly in error about Malthus. Malthus was a pre-Keynesian, it's true. He was worried about underconsumption. But he was only a pre-Keynesian for about 3 years after the Napoleonic Wars and the recession after that. After that, he bounced back and dropped the underconsumption stuff. So at any rate, you can give him a possible lie out of that, but can't prove it. Papers here. Okay, now we get to Keynes's personal style. In addition to his systemic lying and deceit, etc. His personal style was very interesting. Basically, as the Johnsons point out, he flattered his students outrageously. But if you were a student, he'd say any dumb thing you said, he'd say, yes, there's a great point there. So he was very charming and flattering to his students, thereby gathering their loyalty, and he was vicious to any of his colleagues. In public. In other words, he denounced, he'd try to show up his colleagues being stupid in front of their common students. Probably the most vicious single thing he's done, I'm not an expert on how vicious he was, but at least to me, one of the most single vicious things that Keynes did was the way he treated his old buddy Dennis Robertson, D.H. Robertson, who was his former student and colleague at Cambridge, was a much better economist than Keynes. But one of the things about Robertson was he was extremely and painfully shy, even in a period of very shy academics, of eccentrics and all that. He stood out. He's almost pathologically shy. For example, Robertson would write out all of his lectures. Now, this was often done in those days. Okay? He'd write every word out. He refused to take any questions whatsoever. Wouldn't talk to anybody, the key thing for Robertson. In those days, the Cambridge inter-Cambridge mail system was extremely efficient. There'd be like 3 mail services a day. So a lot of people wrote notes to each other. But his secretary was right next to him, and he'd never speak to his secretary, just write a message to her and leave it on her desk. So this poor guy, and a very sweet guy, is obviously filled with gentle quotes from Alice in Wonderland, things like that. And so Keynes, of course, knowing this, exploiting Robertson's weakness, set his students, his intellectual thugs, on Robertson to harass him, denounce him, heckle him, and so forth and so on. Just horrible. Just a systematic torture of poor Robertson. Joan Robinson is one of the people involved in this escapade. So I think that sort of sums up in many ways Keynes's character, the brutality and sadism of his character. Okay, one of the things I want to point out about the general theory, I don't think it's been pointed out enough. He really has a certain sociology and economic sociology and general theory. It's been sort of alluded to here this weekend. He sets up three social classes, basically, the key to his general theory, the three social classes and classes in society. One is the consumers. Consumers are nice guys. Their consumer spending is important, but they're dumb. They're robots. They're passive, determined robots. And they might be lovable in a way, but they're stupid and passive and robots. Then you have the investors. That's the second social category. Investors are not robots. They have free will. They're dynamic. They have free will. They're interesting people and so forth. But they're irrational. They're crazy. They're loonies. They're creatures of mood. They're optimists and pessimists. That's been alluded to here before. And they wake up in the morning, they feel good, they go out and invest. If they wake up tomorrow morning and feel lousy, they stop investing. So you can't rely on them. They're erratic and they're screwballs and so forth and so on. And that's why, and these two classes constitute the national output, national income and output. Fortunately, however, there's a deus ex machina, God out of the machine. There's a third class, government. Government does not determine their free will and they're active and all that. They're not determined by anything. And governments, in contrast to being erratic and moody, as the investors are rational. They're supremely rational. So, especially, of course, if they're guided by a top economist like Keynes. He's the philosopher king, or the philosopher guiding the king. And so the philosopher kings can step in and correct for the moods of the investors. The investors wake up one morning, they're too pessimistic, they don't invest enough, the government steps in and spends. If the investors are too little, too manic, and they invest too much, the government steps in and taxes them, or us. And so the government is the wise governor or balancing machine in the system, since they're wise and supremely rational. By the way, that's the reason why government spending in the Keynesian national income statistics is always considered as similar to investment. It's honorary investment. Whatever the government does is investing because they have free will. And so in contrast, the consumers are robotically determined. So once one points this out, I don't think we have to engage too much to see the fallacies of this assumption. We now get to Keynes's political philosophy, which I'm going to do too much so far. And it hasn't been stressed enough, I think, in the literature. For one thing, there's the famous one key to Keynes's political philosophy is Keynes's foreword to his German edition. This is not even mentioned by Harrod. I don't know if Skidelsky would mention. I think Skidelsky is a very good historian and so forth. But Harrod's allegedly definitive life of Keynes, there's not a single mention of the fact that shortly after the book General Theory came out in 1936, Keynes wrote a foreword for the German edition, which came out in late 36. It came out very quickly after the English edition. And he writes this foreword, which has only been translated by obscure subversives in the United States, like Henry Hazlitt and Jim Morton. And, I mean, it's in German, for those who want to check the translation. Anyway, he says in there, he's talking now about the German regime as of 1936, in other words, the Nazi regime. He says, quote, "The theory of aggregate production, which is the point of the following book, The General Theory, nevertheless can be much easier adapted to the conditions of a totalitarian state than the theory of production and distribution of a given production puts forth under conditions of free competition and a large degree of laissez-faire. This is one of the reasons that I call my theory a general theory." In other words, the theory is general for one reason, because it's better suited to a totalitarian state if you put it into effect than to a rotten free competitive society. So he looked at the Nazi regime. He thought, this is great. It's a beautifully suited to put Keynesian doctrine into effect, which indeed it was. In addition to that, in 1930, Keynes was extremely interested in Sir Oswald Mosley's fascist national economic plan, which he proposed in 1930. And Sir Oswald Mosley set up the so-called New Party, the fascist party, in the early 30s. Skidelsky, by the way, was not I'm going to just correct Mark on this. He's not a lifelong student of Keynes. Before he wrote the biography of Keynes, he wrote a biography of Mosley, so he's particularly suited to understand the Mosley-Keynes connection. At any rate, so much was he in favor of fascism in the early 30s, that Virginia Woolf wrote to an old friend of hers in a letter and said, gee, she's afraid that Keynes might start converting her to a form of fascism. She felt in danger of her soul at that point. As for communism, Keynes was more ambivalent. On the one hand, he admired the young intellectual communists of the late 1930s because they reminded him of, now get this, this is a real corker. They reminded him of a typical nonconformist English gentleman who made the Reformation, fought the Great Rebellion in the 17th century, won us our civil and religious liberties, and humanized the working classes last century, unquote. That's an interview in the New Statesman in 1939. Kind of an odd way of looking at the Communist Party. On the other hand, he criticized the communists for the other side of the Reformation Great Rebellion coin, because they were Puritans, because they believed, of course, in bourgeois morality. Not too many people were more Puritan than an Orthodox Stalinist type. So Keynes's anti-Puritanism then comes out. He's attacking the Cambridge undergraduates who go to Russia in the late 30s and like it. He says, are Cambridge undergraduates disillusioned when they go to Russia, when they find it, quote, dreadfully uncomfortable? Of course not. That's what they're looking for. In other words, he's attacking communism because it's too puritanical. It emphasizes austerity and lack of hedonism. Of course, his moral philosophy is basically hedonistic, and they're anti-hedonistic. They want people to shape up and all that, and that's what he doesn't like. Another thing he doesn't like about communism, in addition to being puritanical, is this proletarian. I think somebody mentioned this yesterday. How can I adopt such a creed which, preferring the mud to the fish, exalts the boorish proletariat above the bourgeoisie and the intelligentsia, who are the quality in life and surely carry the seeds of all human advancement? There, I think we have a key. Who was these grubby proletariat? I mean, he's interested in the bourgeoisie and the intellectual means of power elite. That means him. I mean, he said somewhere, I think somebody mentioned this yesterday, we get down to the class struggle between the bourgeois and the proletariat. He's a bourgeois. Why should he join the proletariat? Well, that's a useful, it's an interesting point. Why indeed? So for all these reasons, he was much more attracted to fascism than he was to communism. To get to Keynes the person, just to sum up Keynes the person, there's one attitude. I'll talk about one attitude, and then I'll talk about my own, I guess. One is Lionel Robbins's attitude. Lionel Robbins converted to Keynesianism, although a new book by O'Brien on Robbins claims he didn't really convert, or he shifted back. But anyway, he certainly did convert in many ways in his autobiography. He writes about Keynes personally. Okay, and this is not irony. I want to point out to you, it's not being satiric here. This is straight stuff. This is Robbins talking about Keynes as he appeared at pre-Bretton Woods conference, the draft conference, Atlantic City in June 1944. He's writing about Keynes. Quote, Keynes was in his most lucid and persuasive mood, and the effect was irresistible. Keynes must be one of the most remarkable men in the world. One of the most remarkable men that have ever lived. The quick logic, the wide vision, above all, the incomparable sense of the fitness of words, all combined to make something several degrees beyond the limit of ordinary human achievement. Only Churchill, he adds, is of comparable stature. And then he says, but Keynes uses the classical style of our life and language, it is true, but it's shot through with something which is not traditional, a unique, unearthly quality of which one can only say that it's pure genius. The American sat in trance as the godlike visitor sang and the golden light played all around. The godlike visitor sang and the golden light played all around. That's Robinson's view of Keynes. Oh, before I get to my own view, I missed something here. I'm going to backtrack a second. He's also appalled at the excesses of communism, and he says, he wrote about communist rule, in part perhaps it, the Soviet rule, is the fruit of some beastliness on the Russian nature, or on the Russian and Jewish natures, when as now they are allied together. Also he said he had doubts, about talking about communism, he had doubts that, quote, Russian communism, unquote, would, quote, make Jews less avaricious, unquote. Okay, so that's the godlike figure. Now, to Robbins, he's the godlike figure with a golden light playing all around the halo. I've got a slightly different assessment. sum up Keynes, arrogant, sadistic, power besotted bully, deliberate and systemic liar, intellectually irresponsible, an opponent of principle, in favor of short-term hedonism, a nihilistic opponent of bourgeois morality in all of its areas, a hater of thrift and saving, somebody who wanted to liquidate the creditor class, exterminate the creditor class, an imperialist, an anti-Semite, and a fascist. Outside of that, I guess he was a great guy.